You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sarah Schulman. Sarah, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you.
Sarah, let's talk about what you're working on now. I imagine it's a number of things, but just to begin to allow the listeners to understand what you're doing, what is it that you're involved in at the moment?
Well, I'm doing a lot of different projects right now. One is that I'm collaborating with Marianne Faithful. Do you remember her?
Sure.
Yes, so we are working together on a musical play that uses 24 of her songs from her incredible career. And it's an adult fairy tale. And that's been incredibly fun. She lives in Paris. She's in her 70s now. She's extremely smart and funny and interesting person. And her songs are remarkable. So I've been doing that.
So before you go into the next project, because that's really interesting, how will that evolve? And you know, that's yeah, I haven't heard of about her in of course quite a while. What will the collaboration be? You're using her songs, and how will that work?
Well, it was initiated by her publisher, BMG, her music publisher, and they contacted me about writing the book for some kind of stage musical using her music. So I talked to her. She has 26 albums. Her first hit was in 1963 as Tears Go By when she was 17. Most people know her for her comeback album in the 70s, Broken English, which is incredible. And she's a lyrics writer. She's collaborated with everyone from, you know, Mick Jagger. She wrote Sister Morphine with him. And she's collaborated with PJ Harvey and Billy Coggins and all kinds of people. And so she writes lyrics, and her phrasing as a singer is incredible. She's not going to be performing this. So we talked on the phone, and she was very interested in a sort of adult fairy tale that addressed some key issues in her life that are very dramatic and adult, built around a survey of her best songs. And so we've selected 24 songs, and some of them are just, there's a song called Present Stranger that I think is really remarkable. There's just a lot of, and then there's a lot of songs that people will recognize. She did a famous recording of John Lennon's Working Class Hero that a lot of people are familiar with, and that's included. And it's a cast of six with a live rock band. And so now we're just developing, we've got the treatment, we're developing the script, and we're looking, trying to amass the artistic team and figure out where it's going to be developed. So it's very exciting.
Wow, that sounds really exciting. And kind of such an interesting sort of, I don't know if that's a genre or not, but using, you know, songs like that and a life like that and a personality like that to kind of flesh out a whole way of, a whole way of communicating to an audience.
Yeah.
Through someone like her. Fascinating. So, okay, let's and other projects, what else is happening?
Well, I my last two books were very, had a lot of gravitas. I had a novel called The Cosmopolitans that I'm extremely proud of. It's set in New York City in 1958. It referred to Balzac's Cousin Bette and to James Baldwin's Another Country. It's a book I worked on for 13 years. And then I followed that with a nonfiction book called Conflict Is Not Abuse. That was sort of like my life's work. I mean, it's this very original and, I think, nuanced way of understanding this period that we're in now, where someone like Donald Trump can claim that he's a victim, for example, as he's scapegoating all kinds of communities, vulnerable people. So that phenomena is what the book is about, and that book has done incredibly well. It's been a very interesting experience this year. I've had larger audiences than I've ever had. I've had a whole two new generations of readers coming in, and that's been great. But both of those books really took a lot out of me. They were very original and worked really hard on them. So my next book is kind of a, it has a veneer of something that's a lot lighter. It's in a detective novel format. And the protagonist is somebody who was formerly in the NYPD. And so it reads like a detective novel. It's one of those kind of, you know, it's written that way and it's easy to read and that sort of thing. But it actually comes from my experience of teaching on Staten Island for the last 19 years, where many of my students were either going to be police officers or corrections officers or working at Port Authority Police, or their families were police families. And so I've had a lot of conversations over many, many years with people who look at things from the police point of view, particularly when Eric Garner was murdered on Staten Island. I, you know, introduced that to my classes, and we had a lot of talks about it. And their point of view as people who identify with the police is quite, I think, something that we need to be exposed to. So that is what the book is grappling with on some very deep level, even though it's kind of a fun detective read. And that novel is called Maggie Terry, and it's going to be out in the fall of 2018. So I'm just sort of finishing that up right now.
Well, go on. If you're about to say something up, say something up, because I'd like to maybe unpack a few issues from that, or conflict is not abuse. But
no,
but
go right ahead.
Go on.
Go right ahead.
Well, is there something else you're also working on besides that book?
Yes, there's a lot. There's a lot more. We could spend the whole time with me listing everything I'm working on. But just one more thing is I did a film 2 years ago with Stephen Winter, who's a wonderful director, someone I really respect and loved collaborating with. And that film was called Jason and Shirley. And it was about the a classic experimental film that was made in 1964 called Portrait of Jason, that was made by the white filmmaker Shirley Clark, in which she conducted a long interview with a black gay man named Jason Holliday in her hotel room at the Chelsea Hotel. And this film is a real classic of experimental cinema, but it's also the first time that a black gay person was ever seen in cinema as the subject. Anyway, 2 years ago, Stephen remade that film, and he did it in a way to interrogate the power dynamics between the white woman filmmaker Shirley Clark and the black gay man subject Jason Holliday. And so I play Shirley Clark in that film. I acted, and Jack Waters, the downtown artist, played Jason Holliday. And we were very happy with the film. It's called Jason and Shirley, and we had a one-week run at the Museum of Modern Art, and it premiered at BAM, and we had a really good experience. So Stephen and I are collaborating on a new film that I'm not going to be acting in, but that I wrote and that he has worked on the script with me. It's called Between Covers. And it's about a lot of things, but it's really about this question of these new kinds of master's degrees that people are buying and that are based on this low residency system that become cash cows for schools, in which people's dreams of becoming writers get transformed into them going into enormous debt to get these master's degrees, and very few of these people actually ever publish anything. And it's become like a factory system. So it takes on that question and many, many other questions, and it's a comedy. So we're working on that together now.
That's exciting. That is a lot, and I know that's just the tip of the iceberg. So to talk about the book that you're working on now, and especially that really complex issue that you're hinting at, or not so much hinting at, but looking at it from the police's perspective of something like the Eric Garner case. Let's talk about that a little, because that sounds like there's some overlaps with conflict is not abuse, perhaps, and a lot of difficult issues. I know, so to talk about that, what's happening in Staten Island, and I bring that up also because although I never mentioned this, I had a friend who was one of the officers years ago. I don't have many friends who are police officers. This was quite a while ago. I knew his parents very well, and he was one of the police officers that shot I don't know if you remember Amadou Diallo.
Of course.
In the Bronx, came out of his apartment, and it was just a barrage of bullets.
Yes.
And killed an unarmed man.
For his keys, yes.
Right, for his keys. And, you know, so his parents are, you know, are liberals, really interesting people that I knew more, art collectors. I had a gallery at that time. And you know, they were, of course, horrified. And from his perspective, he was scared out of his mind. Bullets were flying everywhere. They thought he was shooting. They didn't know what was going on. They're like just kids that you know. So anyway, I don't want to interject that too much. But it was the only snippet I've had a little bit of. You see, the parents of a cop and a cop that you know was so young and so wrong, but also so incredibly naively wrong. And I don't know if this is touching that at all, or you heard some of that in Staten Island.
I don't see it that way, to be honest. I mean, I've been in this milieu like for two decades now,
right?
And I'm not. I don't. That's not my overall perspective. You know, it's interesting. A lot of my students my white students voted for Trump. Their other families did. Most of my students are immigrants, so there's a very distinctly two different demographics. You know, there's immigrants from all over the world who have a lot of aspirations and who speak multiple languages and who can look at the American society in somewhat critically. They have to, in order to fit into it or to understand it, they have to be analytical about it. And then I have white working class students who are mostly Italian American and Irish American, who are often multi-generationally cops, firefighters, and sanitation workers. And their perspective is entirely different. You know, so, like, when I ask, and also a lot of the staff at our school are working-class white people who supported Trump. When I ask them, you know, why did you vote for Trump? I mean, these are people that that I work with every day and have relationships with. They'll say, well, I don't like her, they were talking about. You know, Secretary Clinton. And then I'd say, well, you know, you don't vote for somebody based on whether or not you like them. You vote for people based on their policies. And they'd say, well, I do. I vote for people based on whether or not I like them. So there's already this very fundamentally different between they and I concept of what voting is, of what citizenship is, about how we make decisions, about our collective futures. So then, you know, the conversation gets a little deeper, and I say, well, you know, we're part of the City University of New York, so we're a public school. We're supported by taxes. Your salary is paid by taxes. Our students, their educations are subsidized by taxes. So why are they voting for somebody who wants to cut taxes? Well, a lot of my students don't even know that their education is subsidized. They think, well, I pay, you know, I mean, our tuition is $5,800 a year. 80% of the students are on financial aid. Some people pay something. Many people don't pay anything, but they think, well, I pay X hundred dollars or I pay $1,000. And they think that they're actually paying to run the school. I have students who don't know that they go to a public school. They don't know that there are private schools because they don't know people who go to them. In other words, what I'm trying to say here is that they don't know who they themselves actually are. In that their own actual lived experience, their social experience, is invisible to them. That is what I see as a part of the fundamental issue. That, you know, when I said to my class, we started talking about Eric Garner, and in that particular class I had black, Latin, and white kids whose parents were police officers or people who were married to police officers or corrections officers. And across racial lines, they all supported the police. And it was remarkable to see black and Latino males who I'm sure are, who are endangered, let's face it, walking down the street supporting the police who had just murdered a black man for no reason. And their explanation was that if Eric Garner had done what he was told, he would have been alive today. So then I say, well, are you telling me that the solution to police violence is obedience? And they say, yes. I mean, that's the mentality, right? But I teach creative writing. So people are writing stories about their lives, about their communities, whatever. And one thing I can tell you is that a lot of my students live with a lot of violence in their families. And they don't have a sense that it's not proper, that it's not good for them, that it's a negative social force. There's confusion among my students about whether or not violence is a good thing or acceptable. A lot of my students have fathers who are like Donald Trump, and they depict them that way uncritically. They love their fathers. They're emotionally attached to that kind of masculine behavior of a kind of bullying and a kind of control and violence to them. To certain of my students, that's a normative, that's something they're very familiar with, and they're not critical of it, and they don't see it as a problem. So it's entirely about, in my view, it's about family. A certain concept of not being able to be critical of your family, that it's extremely disloyal to criticize any values that your family holds. And to, you know, it's that's where I'm understanding that police mentality, at least in New York.
So that's very... very interesting and, of course, complex. And you're saying this is something we need to understand and look at. And so, you know, we're talking about this now, and you're writing about this in this new book.
Right, in a very light genre, which is detective fiction. This is not like a big literary book. Yeah.
And
the issues I've just discussed with you are way in the background. This is not the foregrounded subject matter. It's the milieu of the story.
Right. And so what do we do with that information? I mean, as also someone who's an activist, this is kind of very powerful, very insightful.
Well, I mean, I think that the wrong people are police. You know, in Conflict is Not Abuse, I talk a lot about the police. And one of the pieces of information that I share there is that police officer is the occupation in the United States that has the highest rate of domestic violence, personally, higher than NFL players. So police are the people who are the police now are the people who are the least able to solve problems. So asking these people to solve problems in stressful and emotionally complex situations, they are the least capable of doing that. You know, so we need to reconceptualize what kinds of people are in the role of problem solving, or of social problem solving, and what kind of training they need and what kind of support they have and what kind of culture should be around that position. The entire thing needs to be reconceptualized.
How do we do that? That makes sense to me. That seems very clear. Reconceptualizing it means we need to hire different kinds of police.
That's right.
A different kind of training system
That's
for
right.
the police. We need a whole different outlook on what conflict resolution means when even a police officer is going to a domestic dispute, let alone, you know, their
right,
own.
Because right now our entire focus is on deciding who is the perpetrator so that they can be punished by the state. We are not in a place that we should be, where our focus should be trying to understand what's happening. Because if you're trying to really understand what's happening, then lots of different elements and parties are implicated. Or if you're just looking to see who to punish, then it's the weakest person who ends up being punished, which is why we have mass incarceration of poor people and people of color.
So we're in this point in time where it seems like all these things are getting worse. I mean, under Trump,
right?
And just correct me if your perspective is wrong, is different, but it seems like the ball is rolling in the opposite direction, and it's becoming more of everything that we don't want. Looking or that we're discussing right now, in any case, of kind of. Changing the way police operate, changing the way figures in authority manage.
Right. We literally have the Klan in charge of the Department of Justice right now. But, I mean, I can tell you, nobody knows what's going to happen. I mean, everything is so volatile. And, you know, my friend calls it the borderline apocalypse because everybody in charge has borderline personality disorder. It's like the wrong people are in power, and we have no idea what's going to happen. I can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow. I mean, the crazy rate that things are unfolding, and they're not even unfolding. They're just, you know, being expressed.
But also from the environment of school, like a city university. You know, my father also taught at City University. I grew up with parents who were teaching there, and from that perspective, I mean, it was quite different then, but now we're also talking about a generation of college students that also aren't nearly as informed as they could be. I mean, to be mild about it, in the context of what you were saying. So how does that change too? I mean, isn't that also about education, or is it?
Well, I mean, we need a total social. We need another reconstruction. But when you say college student, I mean, you know, I teach in the city university. It's extremely different than the private university system. Who is there? What their conditions are? What they're learning? I mean, everything. It's two. How the teachers act and how they're treated. It's two completely different worlds. So at the City University of New York, we have 23 campuses, and almost 500,000 people are involved in the City University. And like I said, in our school, 80% are on financial aid. But even more important, in our school, only 30% graduate in eight years. That means that 70% of our students are defeated by the system. People who come in with the desire to improve their lives, that's the purpose of education in the United States, and the system defeats them. So it's such a class segregated between private universities and public universities, and then within the public universities. It's all about maintaining a class system. Then when you look at the most elite schools, you know, and you see the kinds of debates that are going on there, they're so different from what our students are talking about. I mean, things like trigger warnings, no one in my school has ever asked for a trigger warning. Never. Not one person. We survey the faculty. You know, the assumptions and the needs of private school students and public school students are entirely different.
And has that always been the case? I mean, my father taught there in the 70s, and I remember even recently talking to the son of a friend of my father's who said that City University system was called the poor man's Harvard. It just had extraordinary teachers there and an amazing system of education. Is that kind of looking through rose-colored glasses, or has it really changed?
I have some incredible students, but they don't have the support systems that they need in order to develop their talents. You know, City University is an open admissions program, and I support open admissions. And then we have flagship schools like City College, Baruch, you know, and then there's schools like mine, the College of Staten Island, that are not flagship. And we have students at every level. I have students who speak four languages, and I have students who can barely read out loud in any language. You know, we have a very, very wide array. But the problem is that when I have a very talented student, I don't have anything for them. This is the thing. You know, we have students who should be going on to, law school, but they can't afford to take the prep classes for the LSATs. You know, it's like at that level, or they don't even know what jobs are. I have students who never heard the words graduate school. You know, they don't, for example, I had an Italian-American girl who was extremely gifted. And I said, like, you know, what's your GPA? And she was like 3.98 or something ridiculous. And I was like, really? What are your plans? She said, oh, I think I'm going to become a nursery school teacher. I was like, really? Because, you know, you could get a free ride to law school. So then she goes, no, I don't think so. You know what I mean? It's like, the idea of going with her talent is was almost inconceivable to her. And she wants to be a nursery school teacher because she doesn't know anyone who's gone to law school. And she lives at home with her parents, and all the kids she grew up with are going to be her friends for life, and they're not going to go to law school. So why is she going to do something that's going to separate her from everyone she knows? You know, like, it's like that. It's lack of information about how systems work and about, you know, like, one of the jobs that I keep introducing to my students is social work. My mother was a social worker. My mother was born in Brownsville, East New York. She went to Thomas Jefferson High School. And then she became a social worker, and she served the city of New York for 65 years. Now, one of the advantages to first-generation Americans of social work is that you've learned how the system works, and you become a point person in your community. So whenever people have troubles, they can call you, and you understand how to get benefits and all this kind of stuff. And I explain that to my students, you know, because a lot of them are the first generation to professionalize. And, you know, and they become interested in it. In that role, but they're not aware of it beforehand. So
it sounds like it's hard to even get over. I mean, this is, you know, it's, you're being so articulate about this, and this is so upsetting for me to hear. Really, in a way that the way you paint this picture so clearly, is there? It sounds like it's almost impossible to get over that hurdle. And, you know, I'd like to think that there is a way or something to push for to get over that, but we're talking about family context and also how the school is set up, and there's you know, the financial restraints of all of this.
Well, it's set up to fail. It's designed to fail. I mean, there's always a few kids you can pull through, you know, that's true.
But why is it set up to fail? I mean,
because
I understand
it's
everything
there to reinforce the class system. That's why it's there. There's no need to have a separate private school, university system, a separate state system, and a separate public municipal system. There's no reason for that except to maintain a class divide.
And isn't that class divide getting wider? I mean, as I remember, when you were a kid, do you think it was the same system, or is this kind of divisions and this separation increasing with every decade?
Well, certain things have had, I mean, like, for example, we know that affirmative action has proven to be socially beneficial. Now we have a government that wants to dismantle it, right? So, you know, when social change and social progress only lived in a countercultural framework, then it was tolerated. But when it starts to actually have an impact, that's when we get a huge backlash like we have now. I mean, this backlash against immigrants, against trans people are the new, you know, punching bag. And this type of, this is backlash against social progress. But these people are in power right now, and they're very dangerous people. So how much damage they can do, I don't know. I mean, getting Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court was a very significant win for them. So I don't know.
Well, it's also a significant win that, you know, as you're saying, and so disturbingly, that so many students who are going to be hurt the most by this administration voted for this administration. So,
well, I think Staten Island is unusual because the rest of New York City voted, you know, for Clinton, but Staten Island is red.
Well, that's true, but a lot of people have. I'm in New Haven at the moment. The gym I went to, I remember I went to the counter one day, and I said, Jesus, I said, it's kind of odd here. I'm talking to a few guys I know here, and they voted for Trump. It's hard to believe. Guy behind the counter said, I did too. The other guy behind the counter said, me too.
Well, did they tell you why? Was it racism, and they hated Hillary Clinton? It's racism and sexism. That's why they voted for Trump. I mean, look at the black vote. 98% of black women voted for Clinton. Right, and I think that other 2%, they weren't wearing their glasses that day. But 20% of black men voted for Trump. Why would a black man vote for Trump? You know, because sexism.
Right. Well, sexism, and there was an interesting post by Eric Fischel a while ago on his page where he said he's talking to the guy that's pouring cement and for his new garage or studio, and they're talking about Trump, and he said, yeah, I voted for Trump. And he said, I know it's not so great for a lot of people. A lot of these guys on my crew might not be here. And he said, well, what do you know of Trump, you know? And he said, well, I worked for him once. He said, I poured cement for one of his towers. And he told me, if you don't do a good job on this, I'm going to pay you 6 cents on the dollar for what you're asking. And he said, and I poured the cement. I did a really good job. And he said, and Trump said, I'm not happy with this. I'm paying you 6 cents on the dollar. And he said, but this is a perfect job. This is the guy that voted for Trump. Right. And Trump said to him, well, I don't think it's a good job. And you can either sue me and you'll be in court for decades and we'll get little or nothing, or you can take 6 cents on the dollar. So he said, I took the 6 cents on the dollar. And so Eric Bischoff said to him, yeah, but why would you vote for a guy like that? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, you know, I kind of respect a hard-nosed businessman. And, you know, it's kind of like, what? And then, you know, the conversation after that, a little bit in that thread was, you know, this is a guy who thinks, you know, the American dream is being rich and
but this gets back to what I was talking about originally, that these people are used to a certain kind of bullying, intimidating, authoritarian male behavior, and they think that that's on some level admirable. And they're identifying with it. This guy voted for Trump, the guy you're describing, because he thinks Trump is going to use those tactics on someone who's, quote, our enemies. He doesn't even understand who our enemies are, quote, enemies, and why they are. And no, Trump is using them on him.
It's really quite an upsetting situation. So it's great talking to you about this. As much as it's, you know, upsetting, it's very, very kind of instructive and I think important to continue to have more dialogue about. When will this book come out that you're working on now?
My little detective novel, it's like a beach read.
Yes.
It's going to be in September 2018. It's called Maggie Terry.
And before we go, I want to ask you what you're reading at the moment for your own interest.
I am reading a book of poetry by Nuar Al-Sadir, N-U-A-R. Al-Sadir. It's called Fourth Person Singular. It was just nominated for the Forward Prize in England, and it's remarkable.
Sarah, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been fascinating.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.